Okay. Michael, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm here.
Thank you so much. Our next,
my pleasure.
Our next guest is Michael Yates, who is an economist, a labor educator, and associate editor of the Socialist Magazine Monthly Review. Michael was born in 1946 in a small coal mining town about 40 miles north of Pittsburgh. And for more than three decades, he was a labor educator teaching working people across the United States. He advocates a socialist view of economics and has written many books, including Why Unions Matter, and his latest, A Great Question for the Labor Forum, Can the Working Class Change the World? So welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little about your family and childhood, how this informed your understanding of what we call the working class?
Well, probably in a lot of different ways. Every member of my extended family pretty much was a worker, coal miners, glass workers, domestic servants, secretaries, cooks. My mother and my uncle and my grandmother actually unloaded dynamite at the face of the coal mine in the town in which I was born, because miners had to purchase their own dynamite then.
I have to tell you, all our mouths just dropped.
Yeah.
Or, had to buy your own dynamite. Wow.
Yeah, well, they used to blow out the holes in the new seams of coal. Dangerous work. And I pretty much took for granted being in the working class. I didn't really even know what that was, really. My parents weren't really political people. My father was in a union, and I thought every town had a union hall, and I thought every town had a factory whistle. So you just sort of take that thing for granted. I think the kinds of things that were instilled in me were a dislike of authority, but a fear of it at the same time. A certain sense of solidarity that you could see from the way your parents acted and the way the people in the towns acted, but also a keen understanding of the perils of what I came later to realize was working class life. Fears and insecurities all the time, worries about money, that kind of thing. Sort of like for everybody in the working class. In terms of my coming to understand that what I was and how the world into which I was born, I think my later education was important. High school and elementary school pretty much worthless as far as that's concerned. They just reinforced the values of the sort of status quo of the 1950s. But in college in the 60s and in graduate school in the 60s, even though I was an economics major, and economics is probably the most conservative of the social sciences, it was still the 1960s, and we had some radical economists, and the Vietnam War was raging, and I started to learn about how the world really works and the world that I really grew up in and what it was. And then when I really started to get a handle on things was when I myself started to teach, when I became a member of the working class in the sense of being a worker, although I'd worked before that. And when I began to teach and I was interested in work and interested in economics, then my path sort of came into true perspective, and I got a real interest in the working class and changing things. I participated in union drives at the college, both for the maintenance and custodial workers first and then for the teachers, and I helped out with a lot of other union organizing campaigns, and kind of my radicalism and grasp of what the working class was and what its possibilities were deepened then.
So, in the studio, we have a former truck driver. Is that right, Cal?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I still got my CDL, yeah.
Okay.
Plan B.
Always.
Yeah.
Diane, who was in manufacturing in auto, in General Motors. Dawn, who's a child care worker now. I worked in the public sector for mass transit. So you spend time at the beginning of the book talking about who the working class is. Could you say a little more?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer with absolute certainty. But I would say that most people that work for wages are members of the working class, but not all. I have a hard time considering prison guards and police members of the working class. They're wage workers, and sometimes they they do good things, but not too often. And so those that I consider members of the working class are those that have the real possibility of bringing about radical social change. So I wouldn't include top officers of corporations and the plaques, the lawyers, the accountants, and so on that work for corporations. I don't think they could be really considered members of the working class as I conceive it, at least in terms of the title of the book. But in addition to that, you have people that are unemployed, people that have become too discouraged to look for work, people that are institutionalized, like most prisoners have to be members of the working class, because if we lived in a good society, most of them wouldn't be in prison in the first place. Mm-hmm. Informal sector workers, people that don't necessarily work for wages. So a lot of these are in the global south. People in India, for example, that roll cheap cigarettes and cigars, people that sell lottery tickets and food in the streets and that sort of thing. The global south is full of those. There are tens of millions of people like that. I also think that to a large extent, although they're not strictly speaking wage workers, I think for the most part you have to consider peasants at least as strong allies or potential allies of the working class. And then you're talking about maybe a couple of billion people in the world, people that have faced the same sort of difficulties as wage workers have. And I think it's important to consider them at least as allies of the working class. And also, would like to just say one more thing about the working class's composition. You read a lot today about how the world is going to be taken over by skilled workers, that everybody's in the precariat. But consider that in the world today, there are over 800 million farm laborers. There are tens of millions of clerical workers, truck drivers, people in logistics, people in the garment sector, electronics workers, and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of people that fit any classical definition of the working class. There's a lot of manufacturing workers. We have a lot of manufacturing in the United States still, but not so many workers because technology and speed up have reduced greatly the need for workers. But even here, there are a lot of classically industrial workers, auto workers, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of service sector workers here and in the world. So the working class is a diverse group of people. And, of course, one of the problems is how diverse it is and how split the working class is. The working class is split by skill. It's split by race. It's split by gender. It's split in all kinds of ways. Employers play those splits up a lot of times. So it's difficult to have a unified force. But if you consider how many people are in the working class, hundreds of millions of people, if even a small fraction of them organize with solidarity, certainly a lot of social change could occur.
I had a statement. This is Dawn. I've done work with Fight for 15 around workers and trying to get a minimum wage raise. And one of the main things that I always felt was nobody could tell the story of the worker. Nobody could tell the story of the proletariat but the proletariat. And how in this society it's one thing, just one minor thing, could set off a whole chain reaction in workers' lives that could cause devastation. And that's not really talked about. I don't know if you talked about that in your book, but just one thing, as simple as a traffic ticket, can wreak major chaos in the life of a worker. Because if you can't pay that ticket, then you end up going to court, and then from court you end up with fees and fines attached, and you can go into probation, and then from probation you can't pay that, and you can end up in jail. You lose your housing, you lose your job. And so can you speak on that?
Well, that's what I was talking about when I talked about my own childhood, the perils of working class life, the fears and the uncertainties, and how any little small thing can disrupt your life completely. What was that town in Missouri? Ferguson, right?
Ferguson, yes.
That policeman murdering that black man occurred.
Michael Brown, yes.
And I was reading, I saw this documentary once about the towns around there and how black people were nervous about even going out of the towns where they lived, which were segregated towns for the most part, to go to work because they had to drive through white neighborhoods, and the police would be waiting for them, and they used arrest of those people to
finance to build up the city government.
The treasury, treasury of local communities. And people would be in jail and on probation and what have you. The bail system, for example, could just wreck your life right there. That was kind of interesting because it showed that some little thing that you're afraid of, that you shouldn't be afraid of, could work a major damage on your life financially. And I think that's definitely the case. By the way, my wife and my daughter were child care workers. You're a child care worker, right?
Yes, making $9 an hour.
There you go. It's
afraid like, I have a blinker out in the back, and I got to get that fixed because...
You don't need a ticket.
I don't need that ticket, man.
No, exactly. So I understand that. Now, of course, you know, as my life turned out, and I was a professor, you know, you don't face that kind of fear normally. I mean, when I went to work there, I was a lowly instructor, and my pay was not very high, and I'd already been drafted 3 times during the Vietnam War, and I filed a suit against the Selective Service System and what have you. My politics weren't such that I was ready to go to Canada, and I wasn't a conscientious objector. But then again, for the first 6 years of my life as a college teacher, I was an employee at will, just like most people are. And for the trouble that I caused trying to organize workers and so on, had they got rid of me, then that meant Vietnam probably, because I would have been drafted. So even there you have insecurities, you understand what I'm saying? So they're not insecurities like my grandmother faced when she was unloading that dynamite in the coal mine. Single mother in a coal mining town and was darning socks and clothes and cleaning the local doctor's office and so on and so forth. And my mother was cleaning the supervisor's of the mine's office, and he attempted to grab her one day and so on. But it wasn't that kind of insecurity by any means. I understand, I think, in my soul those insecurities. And I see some of those insecurities in my children, because my 3 sons are all cooks, and you see a lot of insecurities in the life of a cook, of getting injured for one thing, getting burned or what have you, and then the restaurant closes and things change and you're out of work and you're unemployed. So I have some direct understanding of that. But you're right, and I think one of the things that was good about teaching working people for more than 3 decades was you got to hear the stories of working people in your class. And since I was from the working class, I could relate to that. And so we'd have a nice dialogue. And that's why I always think that like that kind of education is really important. You can't speak down to people. You have to write and act for the working class and not write about them. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of what I tried to do in all of my books. Now, you have to write clearly and you have to write passionately, but you have to write for, with, not about.
And to that point, you write about how we have to, as members of the working class, fight the idea of I and fight for the idea of we. Can you explain what you meant by that?
So there's I have a passage in the last chapter of my book. It's this wonderful passage from Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, which I think I read about 8 times now. And he talks about how as the people are moving west, as the farmers in Oklahoma and the Southwest have to leave their farms, or they're kicked off their land and they have to move to California to take jobs as best they can find them. And as they're moving west and they set up camp, they're all eyes, sort of. They're all individuals. And then one person has a sick baby and another person says, here's a blanket. Or somebody has some food and another person doesn't, and so the food's shared. So the I becomes a we. And Steinbeck says that that's what the powers that be fear. They fear the we. They want to keep us as an I. They want to keep us as individuals. The interesting thing, though, and I tried to stress in the book, is that for most of the time human beings have been on Earth, the we was the strongest. We lived in gathering and hunting bands where survival depended upon group solidarity, where food was distributed on a more or less equal basis. Need would take effect. For example, a pregnant woman would need more food than she otherwise might need, and so she would get it. And they had rules and regulations and strictures against the I, against acting on your own behalf and not on the behalf of the group. And even in the 1600s, a good portion of the land in England, I mean, capitalism had already got off the ground, but a good portion of the land in England was common land, held in common by the people with the right to use it. And so you're acting as a we then. Land would often be redistributed so that no one would have a monopoly over the best land that was common, that was held by all, because sometimes they would plant crops on that land too, besides grazing their animals and gathering firewood and water and that sort of thing. So for most of human history, we've been the we, so capitalism has waged a war against the we and in favor of the I. Like when I was in school, you know, if you wanted to work together, that was like cheating. You had to act on your own all the time, be your own person, don't let anybody copy. Oh, gosh, I can't tell you how many people I let copy off my test in high school. I mean, I was a good student, and if somebody didn't know as much as I did about a certain thing, well, heck, if they wanted to copy, I didn't care, really. It always seemed like not a bad thing to do, but a good thing to do. that might be a silly example,
that's a good example.
You can see that even today, right? I mean, people want to be part of a community. They want to be part of something larger than themselves, but we live in a society where that's very difficult or impossible to do, and it's actively discouraged. And so if the working class is to be a unified force, then it's important to stress the we and fight against the I, fight against our egos, fight against thinking of ourselves first and not of us as a group.
I think it was Audre Lorde that said, the master won't give you the tools to tear down the master's house. And I believe one of those biggest tools is capitalism, like you said earlier. What would it take to destroy that, like to bring it down, and what do we build in its place?
Well, I think that, of course, if you look at, like in one chapter of my book, I have what has the working class wrought? What's it already done? And you can see through labor unions, through spontaneous actions, through political activities, the working class has made many achievements in almost every country in the world. Mm-hmm. It's improved its living standards, its health conditions, and so on and so forth, better laws and what have you. So the working class has achieved a lot. But capital is still in power, so what I think has to be done, since, you know, the basic element of society is that the productive property of the society, you know, the raw materials, the mines, the mills, the equipment, the machinery, those are owned by a small minority of people in the world, and it gets smaller and smaller. So everybody else is dependent upon them, so we're at a disadvantage, and so that ownership, in whatever ways we can, and the power that comes along with it, because it's not just that a small group of people own things. They control the government to a large extent. They control our schools. They control our communities. And so our housing. So we have to battle them on each of those fronts at the same time. Anything that attacks the power that capital has is something that has to be done to bring about change. And at the same time, it seems to me that we have to, whenever possible, and increasingly engage in what you might call collective self-help. Like maybe some of you have read about what's going on in Jackson, Mississippi, or in the urban farm movement in Detroit and other places. You have those kinds of cooperative activities going on in India and in many parts of the world, especially in agriculture, which surely has to be reformed, even if we're to ever attack the environmental destruction going on in the world. Agriculture has to be a key component of that. So those kind of collective self-help majors, like the Black Panthers engaged in, and even before that, to a certain extent, even like groups like the Nation of Islam, engaging in collective actions. The Nation of Islam, for instance, still owns farms in the South, producing organic food, and the Black Panthers had their breakfast program and vaccination programs and all kinds of programs of collective self-help. And those kind of things have to grow and expand within the belly of the beast, so to speak, within the shell of capitalism. So at the same time, you attack the power that capital has. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of electoral politics, but even that, if it in certain circumstances, that's an attack too. But unions are an attack. Working inside of a union to make it better, that's an attack on the power of capital. Housing, occupying housing, for example, squatters movements and that kind of thing, those are attacks on the power of capital. Demands for low-cost, good housing for everybody, those are attacks on capital. Control of the school system, strikes by teachers, those are attacks on capital. Along with these attacks, for example, I noticed that in St. Paul, Minneapolis, they're going to resurrect the old Brookwood Labor College, which is one of the first labor colleges. They're going to start that up again. That's what I call collective self-help, like a college for working people, not affiliated with any big university. So like a simultaneous attack and collective self-help, I think, are probably our best bets. For, like in India, for example, I have a big thing on the Naxalite movement and the Maoist movement in the countryside, where peasants have engaged in land occupations, taking over their land, starting their own schools and their own food production. Now, they've met with tremendous state repression. There have been a lot of political problems and what have you, but that's what I'm talking about.
There's a book I'm reading about Standing Rock, and there's a quote in there from the author that says that in this particular era that we're living in of neoliberalism, it seems easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Can you talk about, with the environmental crisis that we're in, why we need this radical change, not just to free people, but also to save the planet?
Well, there's no question about that. You know, I've just become more knowledgeable about the environmental catastrophes through my good friend at Monthly Review, John Foster, who's the editor of Monthly Review magazine, and he's an internationally known authority on this sort of thing. So I've begun to learn more about that, and you can see it's not just global warming, but all kinds of species are becoming extinct. The oceans are heating up. The land's becoming more desert-like. There are a whole ton of nitrogen from fertilizer being dumped into the rivers and streams, creating dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and all around the world. Massive depletion of fish by kind of industrial fishing, that kind of thing. And agriculture generates a lot of global warming in and of itself, along with the military, too.
Right.
Not often considered in terms of its environmental effects. But certainly, we are running out of time to make the world habitable, period. There won't be any world to change by the working class if the world itself become so inhospitable to life. So that has to be part of all of these struggles. Quite clearly, it has to be very, very prominent, so that all labor union activity, all political activity has to have that environment in its mind as it presses its demands against capital forward. And of course, what capital has done historically is it's expropriated nature. I talk about the twin evils of exploitation and expropriation. And capital has just simply taken nature. It's taken the land. It's taken the water, sometimes because it was just there to pollute. And other times, of course, it took it by main force. And then it uses it for free, in effect, lowering its costs so that it can exploit workers as they work more. So the two twin evils of exploitation in the workplace, where you're compelled to work hours greater than those that it would take to support yourself, to support all workers, and expropriation, the taking of the land, the taking of the bodies of black people during slavery, the expropriation of the labor of women as they raise children and do all that free work for capital to produce the next labor force. Both of these have to be ended, but certainly the expropriation of nature, the damage to our environment has to be foremost in our minds right now. And that's why things like Jackson and the urban farming and the movements of peasants in the global south, that's why those are so important.
Wow. This is Diane. I cannot bear that our time with you has almost ended. So I want to do two things. I want to make sure that we get you back again, because this has been a really super conversation. and fits so much in with what the labor forum here at WRFG attempts to do every Monday, is we really do talk about issues of solidarity and what that means, and we try to bring all the different struggles together: housing, healthcare, job rights,
farm workers.
Mm-hmm. We just had, well, you were perhaps listening, prisoners, police brutality. I mean, it's all part of the struggle of working people to liberate themselves from exactly the kind of mental and physical prisons that capital has put us in. So I want, if you can, in just like 30 seconds, tell our listeners, if you have a website or something like that, where they can find out more about you.
Well, one of the places, you could look at the Monthly Review website.
Okay, Monthly Review website.
I was one of the editors of the magazine for a long time, an associate editor, so I have a lot of articles on there that you'd be able to easily find. And then there's a link on there to Monthly Review Press, so that you could read reviews of the book. You could see other books that I've written for Monthly Review Press and that sort of thing. I had a blog at one time called Cheap Motels on a Hot Plate. I call one word because that's the name of a book I wrote. It's a travel book. and if you type that all as one word, Cheap Motels on a Hot Plate, I haven't done much in it for a long time, but there's a lot of articles in there from the past. There's a five-part section on radical labor education, for example, that people might be interested in. There's some environmental stuff on there. There's labor stuff on there. They're not written in the last year or two, but they're still pretty relevant, I think.
I expect so.
That would be another place that listeners could go if they wanted to find out